And you're listening to the Practice Power Up Podcast with your host, Damian Adler. Damian, the co-founder of Power Diary and a clinical psychologist, will bring to you proven strategies on how to run and grow your practice. Happy listening.
Hello, everyone. Today's topic is it time to raise your rates? And I know this is a question that a lot of psychologists, a lot of health practitioners struggle with and try and work out, when do I raise my rates? When's a good time? How do I go about it? And so today we are going to talk about that, the do's and don'ts of raising rates. And I'm absolutely confident you'll get a lot out of it. So my name is Damian Adler. I'm the co-founder of Power Diary. And I'm also a registered psychologist, and that's how Power Diary came to be, in that we needed some software for our own practice and identified some needs. And long story short, we started a very small little software system and grew it over the years to meet the needs of health practitioners. And now it is used by health practitioners in Australia and UK, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, America, of course, US. All over the world. So it's really come out of this sort of very ground, you know, the grassroots of needing to run a practice. Today, my guest, and I'm very excited to have Gerda Muller. Gerda and I first connected quite a few years ago, and Gerda was a real standout in her space of supporting psychologists and health practitioners. And in fact, I still have my book, Gerda, my copy of the seven-figure practice. Excellent book that Gerda wrote. It is really very, very useful. Lots of amazing content in there that, you know, gives you a clear blueprint of how to develop seven-figure practice. So I still have that. Gerda, welcome. And thank you for joining us and sharing your wisdom today. I'll let you just introduce yourself and give a little bit of background.
Well, it is my absolute pleasure to be here. I was super excited when I got the invitation specifically to talk on this topic as well. Similar to Damian, I'm also a psychologist by trade. I am a group private practice owner. I still own my two group private practices, and that's also how we met, because I'm sure I must have been one of Power Diary's first clients. It feels like I've been with Power Diary like forever. When we went from Google Calendar to a proper system, it was Power Diary, and we still have Power Diary today. You know, other platforms has come and gone, but we are very loyal, but it's because of really great service and support. So yeah, group private practice owner. I am also, my day job, I guess, these days is to be a business coach and mentor to other allied health private practice owners. I specifically work with group practice owners who want to, you know, have more time. I'm a mom of three. I always wanted more time, have more freedom and flexibility, all whilst helping more people and still making more money. And you most certainly can have it all. I'm a strong believer of that. That's me in a nutshell.
Excellent. I think the great thing, and you know, followed your work over the years, and it's amazing to see, have a real knack for sort of cutting through a lot of the noise, I think, in the space that often we have internally, which we'll talk a bit about today, but and helping people with that kind of business side of running a practice while staying in touch with, you know, the important nature of the work that we do and the sensitivity around that. And I think that's a balance that is really hard to achieve. And so big fan, very excited to for you to be able to join us today. So we're going to look at pricing and why it's important. And from your point of view, why do you think pricing is sort of so important for practices, and what happens if people get it wrong?
Oh, like I can talk about this forever, but as you say, I've got a knack for cutting through things. And at the end of the day, the thought that I always have running through my mind when I think about pricing and rates and all of the accompanying topics is that it helps me to help more people in better and more effective ways. Yeah. Ultimately, that's what we're here to do, impact more people. And unless you price appropriately, you cannot fulfill that purpose.
Yeah. I'd agree, and I think my wife and I also have a private practice that we grew and as a group practice, and pleased to say a member of the 7-figure practice milestone as well. And you only get that, don't you, by if you think about the impact on the community, you need to grow, because as a solo practitioner, which is absolutely fine to do, but if your goal is to kind of do that, you need to be able to grow and expand, and without the right pricing, you really get sort of stunted, don't you? It's very difficult to sort of like recruit. It becomes difficult to delegate, I think, because, and this is particularly important for practice at all scales. But if you can't afford to delegate tasks to be done by someone else, I'm a sort of fan of anything that doesn't require your skill set that can be done by someone else, really should be done by someone else, because I remember in the early days, I used to mow the lawn, clean the windows. We used to go in and clean the practice on the weekend, all in the sort of name of trying to, keep costs down and whatnot. But it's a completely, of course, false economy. So by getting that pricing right, you can sort of delegate. And if you're aspiring to have a growing sort of group practice, well, it helps with recruitment as well. But if you're a solo practitioner, then it allows you to get some balance, right? Between being able to work and then not having to do all the other tasks, because you can afford to delegate it to other people.
Yeah. 100%. I'll just put a nice highlighter through all of that, because at the end of the day, if you want to scale a business, irrespective of how big you want to go or how small you want to say, you want to scale, because costs are always going up, even as a solo practitioner, right?
Yeah.
You need one of two resources or a combination of the two. That's either time and or money.
Yeah.
And at some point, you run out of time to go in every weekend and still do all your bank reconciliations and the cleaning and everything, right? And that's when you need to have enough money to pay somebody else. And when you bring somebody else on board, you're changing their life as well, right? You're providing employment. And when you start to connect all those dots, it actually makes sense. If you also think about, like you said, it helps with recruitment. If you want to hire a really great quality clinician to help your clients, you need to be able to afford to pay them really good salaries and rates. And you can't do that if your pricing isn't right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the recruitment side too is if you can afford to have administrative staff and a good administrative team, that can do a lot of those things for clinicians that we know clinicians don't like doing. And of course, PowerDiary is designed to try to minimize administration, but there's still the nature of the work that we do. There's still administration that's inevitable, and processing claims and payments and all those sorts of things. So I think we've certainly found our practice that by being able to have a good administrative team, that's a real selling point when recruiting, because we can say, hey, what are the things you enjoy doing? Hey, you can do more of those things. And typically it's FaceTime with clients. That's what people, enjoy and get into the profession for. And we'll take care of as much as possible of the back end, so they can, turn up, do the work and go home. But again, you couldn't do that, can you? If you don't have your pricing right, then it's not an option.
Correct. When we do recruiting, we like to say, because we believe it 100%, that we offer industry best administrative support. And that starts with a great diary system, right? Yeah. Because if you don't have the right diary, it's just going to cause so much problems. I always call PowerDiary the engine room of the practice. It's, it reflects what's going on. I live 6 hours away from my practice. I can just hop onto PowerDiary and I can see what's happening on the ground. Yeah. And then coupling that with a great admin person, an admin team as you grow. And all of these things cost money, but it's a worthwhile investment. It's return on investment in order to make the money that allows you to have those people on board, which allows you to get great, talented clinicians. And together, we're all changing more lives. And those are those little dots that we need to keep on connecting when we become scared to talk about money and rates and prices.
And on that, let's have a look about what happens with pricing and where some of these kind of barriers kind of you know, that they come in to play. So is it about sort of knowing your worth? This is sort of something that, you know, comes up. But you'd say actually to remove some of the thinking around this, right?
Yes. I often hear in Facebook groups and other communities, people telling one another, you need to charge your worth, you need to charge your worth. But I think that's the wrong way to go around it, because if I make it about me and my worth, well, there's a lot of, you know, underlying psychological stuff that comes into play in there. You know, how I feel about myself, my self-esteem, my self of growing up, my underlying beliefs and all of that stuff. And it's really not about me as a clinician.
Yeah.
It's about the client and it's about the outcomes the client can expect, the value they are getting from the service. It's about how you're going to change their life, how you're going to improve their life, how they're going to be better off. So the value is really in their eyes, not in ours. Yeah. So we should know what we offer.
Yes.
We should know how to talk about what it is that we offer and how they gain. But that's where the value needs to be attached to, not me as a person.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm still important doing this work and I need to look after myself. But clients aren't paying for you specifically. They are paying for how you can help them.
Yeah. And it's sort of by keeping the focus there, and I agree entirely, it's where it should be. It removes some of those distorting factors. I think often undervalue is typically the way that it can go. But then depending, you know, there is the risk of people overvaluing without justifying it, you know, without being able to kind of explain or think of it through the prism of what is, in the interest of sort of, or what is the benefit to clients. And we sort of see this movement too in a lot of professional services. So accountants, lawyers, and so forth, you can see a moving to this kind of value-based pricing model to sort of look at what are they delivering, what's the return on that, and therefore sort of connecting their pricing to that. So this is really good. And now people are going to complain, right, about pricing no matter what you charge. And this is sort of one of the things that sometimes people can kind of get hung up on, right? Like, is this idea of this sort of complaint or this sort of concern. And so we'll look at this kind of, you know, this impact or these sort of psychological barriers that people have. So in terms of this kind of idea around complaints, what have you found with that, and what sort of thinking do you find helps sort of move people on from that worry? Because I think it's that client reaction is often something that's front of mind for people.
Well, there's this saying in business that I always share with my clients. Don't ask me who said it. You can Google it. But it says that unless 30% of potential new clients or inquirers are complaining about your prices, you are not charging enough. Right.
Love it.
That's pretty high, 30%, right?
Yeah.
So when we actually look at data and numbers, when we are increasing our fees and also the clients that I work with, it's never even close to 30% of people complaining. If we get to 5%, that's high. It just doesn't happen. So I think we also overestimate the likelihood of people being up in arms and being upset. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Yes, there's always going to be somebody that's going to complain, but you know what? It's okay. Because we cannot keep everyone happy. And this is probably stuff we tell our clients every day. especially as a psychologist, like, I want to do that. I want to keep each and every client happy, but it's not possible. So let's set ourselves up for failure in this regard. So it's about becoming more mindful of that we're probably overestimating the negative reaction that we are going to get. Maybe we need to, you know, do what we ask our clients to do every day, and that is step out of our comfort zone and do something that is scary and see what happens. You might be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And it is consistently amazing, isn't it, the extent to which overall it's not a big deal. We've had our private practice for maybe, it might be 15 years or something. And there is still, even now, if I'm being honest, a bit of anxiety each time we raise rates, and it's never founded.
Yeah.
It, yeah.
And I find it interesting, and we'll probably talk about this later as well, around keeping things simple, that people often not raise fees for current clients. And I think those are the easiest fees to raise because yeah. they're already getting so much value out of what you are offering. And I know there's probably people thinking right now, but my clients can't afford it. You know, and when I was still doing mostly clinical work, I worked with complex trauma clients. I worked with people with dissociative identity disorder, people that wasn't employed. And I still charged my full fee.
Yeah.
I did not see them for only 10 clients being bulk billed. So a lot of them would come to me after they've seen, had a diagnosis. So I knew what they were coming with. Had seen other professionals that was trying to help by bulk billing them, but that meant only 10 sessions. And now we're out of, you know, Medicare funded sessions. And I would in session one, talk to them about, in order for you to get the outcome that you want, we're going to meet one another once a week. This is what I charge. And I need to see you weekly throughout the year. After 10 sessions those days, you're going to be out of sessions. What are we going to do to make sure you can keep on coming? And it was part of the conversation and people could see the value and they found the money to come. And those days, you know, I was charging like $190 an hour, which was like really expensive back then. But people paid it because I wasn't scared to have the conversation. But the conversation was around what your goals is. And what, how I can help differently to get you there and what's going to be required. And I think we do our clients sometimes a disservice to try and reduce fees, limit the amount of treatment sessions they get when that's not best practice or evidence-based. And then they have a negative experience and they feel like they're failing or something must be wrong with them because they're not getting better. But because I, as a clinician, didn't make sure that they know what's going to be required. And at the end of the day, clients have a choice. Right. Yeah. All about freedom and all about choice. And if a client says that I can't do that or that's not going to work for me in that initial session, then I'll step into more of a case management role and go, okay, so I now know what you need. You know what you need. I'm going to help you find a service that can you support you to get exactly that. And that's how my role would change. And I would do that. And some people I would then have to refer out, but I would make sure I find a place for them. Or they would stay and we would do amazing work together. And, I'm sharing this story because I think it's really important because a lot of us think, but I can't do this with my demographic. Because my clients, I can't do it. You can.
Yeah. I in fact, I've got a similar story when I was working in the public mental health system for a number of years. And when I resigned from there and said that we were going to start a private practice, that exactly. Director at the time, so my employer said, I live in Ballarat, which is in sort of regional Victoria. It's not an affluent area. It's a, it's a typical kind of a town. And they, at the time, too, this is going back, they were saying, I don't think, you'll be able to run a private practice here, like, and grow it and have scale. There's not like you're going to have to bulk bill. And, and I said, look, absolutely not. We will not be bulk billing. There's not, if you do the modeling, it doesn't work. So we're not going to be doing that, but we're going to be offering exactly. And from, day one, in fact, even before we opened the doors, the phone, started ringing and it never stopped. And I think this is the thing that sometimes we make assumptions and, spoken to lots of practitioners over the years that have make assumptions about the affordability for clients too, because we may know some through therapy about their context or their financial circumstances. And we can sometimes extrapolate that or assume that that means that they are necessarily limited in finding funds for treatment where there's a clear treatment plan, agreed goals and so forth. And over the years, it's amazing the creative ways by working with people, like you say, that we've had employers step in and say, well, we'll redirect EAP funding through to this person. We've had, family members who have contributed. We've had, people that have been able to access funding through government services, employment services, all sorts of things. So at least if you have the conversation rather than make an assumption and then come into the conversation, I think people come in defensively, assuming that the outcome's already known almost and come into it apologetically as clinicians. And I think being really clear about, as you outline, it's a very different conversation, and it's a different response than what often we expect. And of course, there are scenarios. I mean, there are of course scenarios where there isn't a viable option for people finding one. But like you say, there are then pathways that we can encourage and people to take and support them, into that, and just narrow the focus of treatments to what can realistically be achieved, based on the evidence. The other comment here before we just move on from this point is that we often see sort of, I think, practices confuse their sort of altruistic and charitable kind of work with their business, the business drivers. And they kind of will say, well, I'm keeping the fees low to kind of increase accessibility and things like that. And it's a real fallacy, I think, in terms of how people think about that, because it jeopardizes the overall integrity and operation and future of the business. And that will certainly reduce your impact in the world if you can't operate, or you can't expand, can't grow, or you're so worried if you're a solo practitioner, you're worried about finances, that's going to distract you. But the counterintuitive element here is that when practices, I think, price correctly and are profitable, that profit actually gives you the freedom to make very conscious decisions about if you choose to do either pro bono work or to do in particular circumstances, a discounted for a particular reason, not as part of, the business operation, but, those unique cases where you might decide. But it gives you that freedom, right? Which you can't do if you're applying essentially a discount to everyone, whether they need it or not. You've had experience with that too. You can find yourself in a position where you can have more freedom this way.
Oh, most certainly. I think if we are just discounting everyone, or we are undercharging, or just bulk-billing everyone, we are actually contributing to one of the things clinicians and practice owners complain most about, and that is that people undervalue us. Yeah. And that generally the public undervalue our service. But when we model that undervaluing of the service, then we really can't complain, right? So it starts with us. We need to value our service first and foremost. We need to be good at charging appropriately by showing it through our prices, by communicating it through our messaging and marketing and branding and all of that stuff. And as you said, it doesn't mean you throw giving back and altruism out of the window. It means that you can ensure that you have before you can give, right? Yeah. Like the old saying, put on your oxygen mask. You need to look after your team and your business, and then you will have money left over to do something altruistic. And I think a story I've shared with you previously, and I'll be very quick, is and I've just spoke earlier about the fact that I always, charge a relatively high fee, full fee for my work. And I once had a client that had a very severe phobia of hospitals, was diagnosed with cancer, and had to get her into hospital for an operation. And I spent the whole day with her, going in, sitting with her, walking her into the operating theater, all for free. Because she couldn't afford it, and I could do that. And I not even once thought twice about saying yes to doing this program. She wanted to pay. I said, hell no, I'm going to be there for you. And it made me feel really good. So sometimes that's about us as well, giving back and being altruistic. It's really good to do it. The client really appreciated it, but I could only take a whole day out of my clinical work because 10 out of 10 times really, but appropriately. And I charged my full fee, but therefore I could do this for that specific client.
Absolutely. And then you're able to help from a position of strength. And so you have genuine choice, and you can give back at the scale that is needed for the situation. That, it's exceptional. But if you were undercharging, booked back to back, overbooked because you're trying to, manage financially, there's no way that you could afford to do that. Absolutely.
Work smarter, not harder. Power Diary, the complete practice management system for allied health professionals. Our all-in-one system with over 100 powerful features for health practitioners includes appointment scheduling, client messaging, SOAP notes, telehealth portal, payment integrations, and much, much more. Let Power Diary streamline and simplify your day-to-day operations so you can take care of clients. Join a live demo or start a free trial today. Learn more at www.powerdiary.com.
Okay, so let's have a look at some strategies. Hopefully we've convinced people by this point that they really should, you know, look at increasing their rates. But let's look at some strategies about sort of, you know, how to do it and deciding how much you should actually charge. And so people will sometimes sort of go about it backwards, right? But there's a different take that we're going to talk about today.
People like to follow approaches such as, you know, what is everybody else doing? So they do market research. Market research is good, but that's not the only reason how you decide your fees. Or they have a supervisor and they ask the supervisor how much I should charge. And sometimes the supervisor's never been in business, right? Or they ask people in a Facebook group how much I charge. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Right? That's not how you do it in business. You can do all those things, but at the end of the day, you need to come back to the numbers, because the numbers never lie. It gives you things, you know, it's the clarity that you need. So as we're saying here on the slide, you know, you need to know what your cost is. So if you are already in practice, I would encourage you to look at, you know, how much does it cost you to run your practice over the last 6 months? And then add 10% to that, because we know things are just going up from here on forward. I mean, if you're a business owner in the last 12 months, we had a super increase. You know, a lot of stuff has increased. And then you work out, okay, if that's going to be my cost, how many clients should I see based on, you know, the current amount that I'm charging? How many clients should I see to actually cover those costs? Right? So you look at how many clients that I have divided by that number, and then you'll know your break-even amount, and then you need to ask yourself, do I actually want to make a profit? How much profit do I want to make, right? And then you build all of that in. So you need to have a way to actually calculate the numbers that will then tell you, if I want to pay all these expenses, make X amount of profit, how much should I be charging based on our current capacity? So based on the current number of clinicians seeing clients right now, after cancellations and no-shows, how much should I be charging?
Yeah, it's great to take it from, because it's the business reality, isn't it? Yeah. You know, that this is, you calculate it that way so that you know, sort of start with the end in mind, if you like, that, okay, we need to know this, the outcome is that we're profitable, sustainable, can afford to grow, there's a return on risk. So we work backwards from there, then that gives you, you know, that number. The other thing I was just going to comment on was around this idea of increasing in anticipation for future increase, because I think that's important. We know the next 12 months there will be further inflation, pretty much anywhere in the world that seems to be the trend. And so people often just retrospectively, it's like a catch up, and then they kind of absorb that, you know, throughout the time, and then it's a sort of catch up. And, you know, it means systematically we're kind of doing things that are not really in the best interests of the business. And I think the other comment that we, you know, see on forums and talking to, you know, to our customers at Power Diary, that people sometimes are reluctant because they're saying, well, the costs are going up. And then thinking about that from the client's point of view, all the client's costs are going up, and they're trying to like hold back the tide, you know, and say, oh, well, we're trying not to. And whilst it's, you know, can understand it from a passion point of view that someone might, it doesn't hold up in from a business sustainability stress, any way you cut it. The reality is we're not, as practice owners, in any way immune from the cost increases. And trying to hold back the tide, you know, is not going to work. We need to kind of continue to make sure the business is viable. And at the end of the day, if there are, I think that sort of the market forces sort of work on governments and insurers as well over time, because if the reality of the costs and the rebate, if that's applicable, so if there's Medicare or other rebates available, as the gap increases, it puts political pressure, if it's government, or it puts pressure back on the insurers to bridge that gap to come at least somewhat a step towards reality. They'll never reach reality, right? Because they're, but at least instead of the practice trying to absorb it and shield, it's better to say, well, no, this is the reality. Let it be what it is, and then let that sort of have this backwards, this influence the way it should on policymakers and the people that kind of set these things. Otherwise, if it's a hidden issue or the practices are absorbing it to their own detriment, that won't change.
Yeah, and again, then we are devaluing what it is that we do, and then we can't complain about it if we're devaluing
exactly.
it. I know I can be hard on that point sometimes, but it's the truth. And it's not our job to rescue our clients from a recession or inflation or cost of living increases. It's our job to facilitate and help them get through it, just like we need to as individuals, but also as a business. That's our job. And I think our clients probably understand that we need to increase our fees. They probably are expecting it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Because everybody else is increasing their fees. Why wouldn't the psych practice? And then it comes back again to us having to be really good in our messaging, our marketing, and our branding, and how we talk to clients about the value of our services.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll jump into that. Just before we do, this is a question about should I conduct market research? And this goes to that point you made about, this is sometimes almost like the sole way that people, do this. And I think the point that we'd sort of, want to make here is that, it's okay to do that, and it's okay to get a sense of what the market is saying, but not as the decision maker. It's more just understanding sort of context to see where you fit in. And, if you are way higher, that's okay. But then it brings that focus of making sure that you're communicating value and marketing, as you say. Yeah. If it's way lower, then is it really that your cost base is so much lower than everyone else's? I would suggest it's not. So we've got to look at why are we sitting at the sort of bottom of the market and what is that saying about value proposition. So if people are at the bottom of the market to attract clients, for instance, then I would suggest that there's a need to review the way in which the services are being communicated, marketed, and so forth. So nothing wrong with market research, but don't use that as you very well said, don't use that to be the thing that guides you all the way through. We're coming to the end of the year. We've got a brand new calendar year about to, set upon us. So that sounds right, like the perfect time to raise rates, wouldn't you say, Gerda?
No.
No, definitely not. Okay, walk us through this. Because that's what we often is the default thing, right? At the start of the year, let's raise rates. But you're definitely not. Okay, let's hear it. Let's cover that. Why not?
Well, let me just say, if you were thinking of raising it in January, you're not alone. Majority of people think this is the right time to do it. And the second right time people normally think is start of the new financial year. It's normally one of the two. And I say January and February, for that matter, is the worst times to actually increase your fees. Despite me all for increasing your fees, charging appropriately and valuing your service, you still want to be clever about when you do it. Right. And you want to do it at a time that clients are going to be most accepting of it. And I think we're still going to talk about objections and stuff. And you want to do it at a time where there's going to be the least amount of objections. We still want to manage those things because we're still clever business people. And when you think about it, December is a high spend month. I've got three kids, I've got family coming over, it's expensive, it's just the food is so expensive, and then you've got events and it's end of school and all of these things that you need to pay for and you want to go on a holiday. We all have more expenses in December. I find at our practice, December is a January month, a lot of people are coming in, we're very busy, all of that type of stuff. People are in spending mood, but majority of us also overspend in December, unfortunately, even though we tell ourselves not this year, it happens. And then in the bright light of January, when we wake up, maybe not on the 1st of January, we are still on holidays then, but like 3rd, 4th, 5th, it's like, oh my goodness, what did I do? Here comes the credit card bills, and now I need to go and buy all the back to school stuff, and it's new school clothes and shoes and all of this stuff. And it's like, And now my psychologist fees are going up by $20. Maybe I'll have to cancel this one and just go back only in February because I've got all these expenses. And, and that's probably why a lot of people tell me that January is a quieter month. And by increasing our fees, we are making even more quieter if we do it in January. So let's be helpful to our clients in this scenario. Let's make it, and of course, increase by either increasing it on the 1st of December, or I would say, you know, 1st of February, no, 1st of March. Because 1st of February is people are, is back to school time again, right? My kids are back to school like end of January. There's so much stuff just happening for clients. So those are the 2 months that I would absolutely avoid. So if you're not ready for a 1 December increase, I would encourage you to do it the 1st of March. And all those worries that you have about people pushing back and objecting, most of those won't even happen because you've selected great months to increase it in.
Absolutely. And I think for those that in the Northern Hemisphere that have their long school holidays over that July kind of August period, and we see there, there's often a natural break in treatment because people are on holidays and are doing things. And I think the same principle applies, even though they may not have the credit card bills arriving, you know, necessarily in July or August, although we do know expenditure goes up during school holiday times. But there's still that kind of break in treatment. And I think that when you add a barrier or perceived barrier, and you don't, the freshness of the relationship, the regularity, the momentum of the treatment is interrupted, the same principle applies. So look at a sort of September increase instead of it being a July, August, where we're already needing to do some work often to re-engage clients in their regular appointments. Now, of course, you've booked them ahead and you've done all those things and you've got reminders going out and sent them some things on the holidays, you know, some tips or something to keep you front of mind, but still, that there is a disruption to the pattern. And that's, I think, the way to kind of think about this is that, you know, like you say, make it as easy as possible and as part of get the momentum of the treatment and do it during that time rather than where there are these natural breaks or barriers or expenses that can sort of throw people off. So this is good. And this is, you know, something that while we were, you know, thinking we need to get this message out there, right? Because it's such a common thing. And it's entirely, when if you don't think about it, it just seems completely logical to do it, right? Start of the year, keep the books clean, very easy to do. But like you've said, not so good.
Yeah. And if you've been asking people in Facebook groups, when should I increase my fees? Most of them are going to tell you I'm doing mine on the 1st of January. And then you think, oh, well, that's probably the done way.
Yes.
You don't think it through. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I actually happened to see a short video yesterday on YouTube that popped up talking about following the follower syndrome, like where, or a scenario where, you know, that the group, you know, that you ask a group and the group's going to give you an answer and then you're part of the group that then gives the same answer the next time someone asks, right? So, you know, it's this. So it's really, it's, yeah, great to get opinions. I'm not at all against any of those things, but keep it in context and, you know, keep your objectives aligned and you know, you can think about it independently as, you know, as well. Okay, so communicating price changes, how soon? What do you think? What's reasonable notice here? So we were talking maybe 1st of December as a date or later. So the 1st of December wouldn't give people a whole lot of time right now. So what's your recommendation around this for as a guide?
Yeah, as a general rule, I like to give our clients 4 to 6 weeks notice. I would say 4 weeks is minimum amount. That's what I would recommend. Yeah. I know of people that's done it shorter, but, you know, again, you want to still, you know, be considerate whilst increasing your fees. So that's what I would do. So if you've run out of time for 1 December, because there might be some prep work that you need to do, you know, just hang on before you know it. It's going to be the 1st of March and I would just do it then. And go from there.
Yeah, and I think too long as well can have issues as well in that it doesn't have any, it's not meaningful to people yet, so they don't really factor it into to sort of anything and it perhaps it doesn't really add a lot, you know, to it. It sort of gets people too focused on it unnecessarily.
And I think very often that's more to deal with our own anxiety around increasing it so that we can feel better for increasing it because I gave them 3 months notice, right? Yeah. But people don't need 3 months notice. Like you said, I would have forgotten about it already. It would be new news to me, although I might have read it. It's like, what, is it increasing again? Then again, you're asking for trouble. So rather keep it a bit shorter, 4 to 6 weeks. Follow that how to communicate, which means that points that we've got on the slide, which means that people are seeing at various places that it's coming. I always say people should know that a fee increase is coming. You don't want anybody rocking up to the front desk saying, oh, I didn't know. It's the same with cancellation fees. I always say that your clients need to know that there's fees. It's your job to make sure that they are aware of it. And it's the same with our fee increases.
Yeah, that's right. They get fair notice. And multiple touch points is the key here too, isn't it? It's because we all know the admin team, or if you're working solo, you may know for a fact that you've mentioned it and you've talked about it, but people will sometimes be absolutely confident that they weren't aware and they didn't know. So, making sure, and that's fair enough because people, busy and things can go in one ear and out the other for all of us at times, but having those multiple touch points, utilizing your software to support you in that as well. So with PowerRE, you can email out in bulk or send SMSs. You can put it on the bottom of the invoices. There's a section where you can add custom invoice text in there that goes out on the template. And of course, hitting your social sites, if that's where you've got, depending on how you use social, if you do use it, that can be useful as well. People can also append in like their SMS reminders. They can have their web page up, and then just put one of those shortly or a miniaturized URL in the text message, and that people can then click on and go through. So it doesn't use many SMS characters if they shorten the URL, but it allows them to say new fees, click here. And then that way you're going to reduce the risk of people not being prepared and therefore getting a negative reaction, which of course would reinforce the beliefs that the person had at the start that people are going to object. So if you mishandle it, definitely you will see more objections. So let's not self-perpetuate that particular dynamic. Okay, so this is a step that I think often is either forgotten or not handled well. And that's sort of managing the team's perception. So this is really about the internal dynamics of a fee increase. What happens, do you think, when if people don't handle this proactively, I should say, too, because it gets handled one way or the other, but proactively, what happens if people miss doing that?
Well, unfortunately, people are people, and when our clinicians aren't business owners, our admin team members aren't business owners. They don't know what they don't know, and when people don't know what they don't know, they jump to assumptions. And unfortunately, if a practice seems to be doing really well, it's easy for people to assume, well, obviously, the practice owner must be lining their pockets, right? Or, they bluffing all the way to the bank, or those are just some of the sayings I've heard that people have actually directly told me, clinicians. So we want to make sure that we address any of those assumptions, right? And it's not about you explaining yourself. Like, a lot of practice owners will go, but I don't have to explain myself. These are all these costs, and yes, these are all legitimate. But if you want your team to be fully behind you, you're going to have to open up that a little bit of a window towards what's happening in the back end of the practice, because they don't know. And I've run this exercise in team meetings with my team before, where I've gone, okay, so let's have a look at the numbers. We've just gone through the end of the financial year. We know exactly what the numbers look like. And I made it actually a really interesting and interactive discussion in terms of, okay, 100% of the money's coming in. How much of those do you think goes to the team, or what do you think is the biggest overheads? That was an actually interesting discussion, getting them to tell me what the biggest overhead was. And I clearly remember one of the biggest aha moments was the amount of freaking stationery that we used to use back then when I still ran it myself, right? We couldn't believe that we spent so much on stationery.
Yeah. Yeah. And back when we did the same thing, and we used to have business cards, like we'd have, you know, printed business cards. This is a long time ago, you know. But the cost, right? It's amazing how, like, with, you know, and they used to be individualized for each clinician as well. So we didn't even get the full bulk benefit of the big order because they would be, you know, each. Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an eye-opening exercise for the team to go through it. So I do think we need to, you know, trust them enough that, you know what, they're going to benefit from this exercise. We are going to benefit from this exercise. And in the same vein, I would also talk about profit to the business.
Yeah.
Because that is okay. Not only okay, it's actually required for you to have a business and not an NGO.
Yeah.
Not a charity and not to be doing volunteering, you have to make a profit. And, you know, the way that I look at it, let's say if we look at an employee model, when you speak to an accountant, a good accountant will tell you that your employees need to bill 3 times what they cost the business, right?
Yeah.
3 times. So 1/3 of that money will go towards covering the costs, wages, and all on costs for the employee. Another 1/3 goes towards operating expenses, which is our OPEX. Yeah. And then the other 1/3 gets divided into another 3/3. So the one is for expansion, right? You want to grow, you want to help more people, you want to buy an ADOS assessment kit or whatever it is that you want to do. The other 1/3 goes towards working capital, having money in the bank, sitting there, cash flow for when the pauper hits the fan and recession is around the corner, they tell me. And then the other 1/3 of the 1/3 is profit.
Yeah.
So, and that profit should still be there. You need that. And I think it's really important to share things like that with the team so that they get, okay, this is why we've got KPIs. And of course, there's a different type of distribution of fees for contractors. But unless they get it, they're going to jump to conclusions. So let's get the record straight. Let's trust them. I'm not saying open up your profit and loss statement to your employees. No, that's not what you do. That would be like not having great work boundaries. But it's about knowing how much to share and what's going to be helpful to them.
Yes. Yeah. And it just counters that sort of instinct of I think team members, there's just no way that without that they would know the true cost. Like everyone underestimates it because they don't think about the fact that every single thing that you look at in a practice has to be paid for. Like every, you know, if the light's on, if the floor's clean, if there's flowers on the, what, everything, you know, has to be paid for. So, and it's very easy. I think, we habituate pretty easily and we just sort of zero all that out in our mind because that's always just there and that just happens. Mm-hmm. But, we did the exact same thing with our practice from day one because for the same reasons is to keep the team on board, particularly as at the time we were charging, you know, the higher rate than what the market would indicate, like if we were doing that kind of thing, so it looked like, but that's because exactly those things that we wanted to grow, it had to be sustainable, and it was a business. We're taking risk in the business, and you should expect a return on that risk and on that effort. You know, otherwise it's like you say, it's not being responsible in terms of, you know, that the longevity and the health of it. So I think this is great. And just that kind of concept, and you can ease your way into it. If you have never done any of this before, ease your way into it, start bringing that kind of discussion into meetings and things. I used to also talk about sometimes when things would happen, I wouldn't hide the cost. So if the photocopier and the printer broke down and it cost $800 to get the person to come out and, you know, do whatever magic they do, right? To be able to say, like, okay, you know, just not hide that thing and say, man, that was $800. That's nuts, you know. Mm-hmm. Just even as a passing comment or a joke about, you know, where something, but just to kind of keep the idea that these things are genuine costs that have to be paid. And then the team, the sort of resistance, or the perception keeps people on board. The other thing just quickly on this too is around, I think if you look at lawyers and accountants and the difference between what they bill and what they get paid as employees or as contractors, psychology is super generous.
Extremely.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It is, you know, and you see these like debates sometimes, you know, about percentages and this sort of stuff, and you know, and it's unconnected to cost in the discussion and all these sorts of things. You just think, wow, I mean, it's an industry, there's a bit of a bubble element that sort of is a bit unusual. Like when you look outside of that to say, well, what are consulting style businesses? What, how do these ratios work? You know, there is, like you said, that even third. And in many law firms and things, that would be, you know, there would be more way, you know, the wages cost or the contractor costs would be, might be, they might be getting 15% of their, you know, so, you know, we need, again, it's that mindset. This is, you know, if we pin it in reality of running a business and work backwards, as we've talked about, then that's the thing that's stable and reliable, you know, to judge this sort of stuff on. So some just quick tips for handling objections from clients to referrers. And I think the first point to make here is that by doing the other things we've talked about today, we want to minimize objections, but inevitably we're going to have some there. So the tips around sort of using this is around having like some scripts, right, about how to respond to these things. And these can be stored in Powder as a practice manual that is now integrated in, where you can store your scripts and your training materials and your how to, you know, all your procedures for things. And but it's better, right, to have to anticipate and have a agreed way to respond.
Yeah. Again, as you said, if you follow the process, this is going to be limited. You have to expect some level of pushback even. You're probably going to tell me there was almost nothing noteworthy. But if there is, it's about going, okay, well, you know, we should expect something, and it's okay for people to object. And sometimes people are happy to pay it, but they feel like they need to just let you know that, you know, this is inconvenience. I could have used that money, you know, for something else. And that's okay. Yeah. Doesn't mean you need to jump in and rescue them and give them a reduced fee. That's not your job. You know, and it's your job to listen, make them feel validated, and, you know, just talk. Don't be scared to talk through that discussion. And I would encourage clinicians to do that if it's current clients. Clients, you know, are happy to have those conversations with clinicians. If it's raised at the front desk, you know, our front desk people aren't the clinician. So give them the scripts and do a bit of a practice run with them in terms of what they could say, for example, that type of thing. 9 out of 10 clients just want to be validated and want to know that you've heard that, you know, this is maybe a bit harder for me. And it's just about making them feel listened to, and then just say, you know, are you still good for that appointment 2 p.m. next week with so-and-so? And then go from there. When people complain, it doesn't mean you have to reduce it. I think that's really important to note. You can hold the line. And if somebody... most certainly, if there's like no way this person can afford it, then we would always look. I mean, when you have a big group practice, so this is different if it's solo group, but if you have a big group practice, you probably have clinicians charging different amounts. Yeah. So for us, you know, depending on people's level of experience, we will charge them out at a higher rate. So let's say if somebody that's really senior, their rate is, let's say, 260, they can't afford it, there might be an option for them to see somebody else at the practice for 230, right? Yeah. That's an option. And for a lot of clinicians, it's like, I can't do that. Well, it's client choice. The client can choose to stay with the current clinician, pay the 260, or they can see someone else, will do a great handover because it's all in-house, and they can see somebody and still get a great service, continuity of treatment for 230. That's more affordable for them. So there's other options other than reducing fees. And if you can't help somebody in-house, then again, it's stepping into that case management role and going, maybe this is they're not the right service for this person, especially if in the past we weren't charging appropriately. It's important for us, if you are a private practice, to know that private means that you are a business, a for-profit business, and you've got a responsibility to run a fiscally sound business.
Yeah.
It means you cannot operate as an NGO. And if somebody is at with you, then maybe you're not the right service for them. Then you might need to find an NGO, public health, or somebody else that is a more suited service. And maybe that's a mistake that you are fixing up for taking on somebody into your service who wasn't really a right fit, because maybe you just didn't know what you didn't know. And there's, you know, there's no shame in that. There's no judgment, but it's about, okay, I now need to fix this. Let me help this person get the right support for them that can be there for them over the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think often it's, you know, ironically, it's actually the clients that need long-term treatment where this sort of dilemma, and you see clinicians hesitating about, well, they need the treatment, but they can't afford post the price rise, but, and therefore sort of, you know, contorting themselves to try and, you know, make an exception or do something, but actually strategically for the client as much as for the business, that's actually the client that where there is a, you can actually see they need long, potentially long-term treatment. You know, now, like, you're not the right fit for that long-term. So it's actually a disservice to kind of keep them sort of artificially in an environment where, you know, that relationship is at some point, you know, it may need to end prior to the where it's clinically indicated. So it's better to, like you say, correct the misstep and focus then on, you know, the getting the person linked in. So, you know, to what they actually kind of need. So an action summary, just to kind of finish up. So getting it done. So understand your price, you know, your pricing and where it sort of, you know, where you sit in the market, not to make the decision, but so that you can know, make sure that you are pitching the value correctly. But it's, so acknowledge your psychological barriers, change that mindset. Go an action plan and a timeline for adjusting your rates. So that's idea of getting that timing right and put it in plan, communicate it with the team, so that everyone knows. And the idea of doing the same date every year is a great one, which I think you just touched on in one of your answers before. But so that it becomes a regular thing, the team know, clients know, you don't have to think about it and risk, you know, missing it for a few years. Get the communication straight to the team, let them know why, and then have that plan in place for dealing with any objections that might still come through. So I think that summarizes what we have talked about today. So thank you, Gerda, for your wonderful insights here. And if people would, you know, it's great to, you know, and I think people have got a lot of value out of today to sort of really just keep their kind of thinking clear on this and really set themselves up for success. If people would like to connect with you and follow up or get more information, what's the best way for them to reach out?
Various options depending on what you need. First stop is generally the website, which is gerdamoller.com.au, which, you know, just has everything on what it is, who I am and what I do. If you go, you know, I need some business coaching and mentoring, you can email me directly at that email address, which is gerdam@private-practice-success.com, just to start a conversation. I do have a amazing Facebook group for practice owners. So if you search for Private Practice Success for Allied Health Professionals, there is a Facebook group. Just send us a join request. Be sure to answer the three questions or we won't let you in. And join the discussions in there. Another great thing is, you know, check out the book. That's a great resource. People tell me that it made such a difference for them. That's something they can check out. But those places, you will find a way to contact me, but email is probably the easiest, and I do personally respond to that email address that's in there. So happy to chat with you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Practice Power Up podcast with Damian Adler. Come back often and make sure you subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. Your feedback is important. Don't forget to join us next week for another exciting episode. See you then.